ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to constructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. Rita Hayworth is our centennial celebrant for the month of June, and guest Nell Manow joins me as we look at Rita Hayworth's 1946 noir feature, Gilda.
There never was a woman like Gilda, or a picture like Gilda. Columbia's outstanding screen triumph starring Rita Hayworth with Glenn Ford. One man bought Gilda, another hated her and hungered for her. Gilda, inflaming men's hearts with a kiss or a song.
Before Rita Hayworth flipped her hair to stardom with Gilda, she started life as Margarita Carmen Cancino, born in Brooklyn, New York in 1918. The family business was show business itself. Her father, Eduardo, was a Spanish dancer whose father had popularized the bolero in Spain, and Margarita's mother, Volga, was a dancer with the Ziegfeld Follies. Rita's father wanted his daughter to do what he did for a living. As Rita herself once said, quote, "As soon as I could stand on my own feet, I was given dance lessons." But dancing was a burden for Rita. Quote, "I didn't have the courage to tell my father, though." By the age of 5, she was performing as part of the Four Cancinos dance troupe on Broadway, and at the age of 8, she made her film debut in La Fiesta, a short for Warners. In 1927, Eduardo moved the clan to Hollywood, where he established a dance studio, teaching the likes of Jean Harlow and James Cagney. But his goal was to get his family into the movies. Rita's father soon singled her out as the golden ticket, forming an act called the Dancing Cancinos. He and Rita danced at all the popular night spots while she worked in movies during the day. At 16, she took a part in the 1934 film Cruz Diablo, and from there, she was working regularly in movies.
Pardon me, but your husband is showing.
Oh, thank you. Perhaps again sometime.
Until that sometime, I shall only miserably exist, senora.
I always say there's something about mad men. For one thing, they can dance. For another thing... What's your telephone number? Never mind. I'll give you mine. Cujo 3017.
Cujo 3017.
Ha sido un placer bailar con usted, Captain.
El placer ha sido mío, señora. What did you say to him?
I just told him if a man answers, hang up. Wasn't that all right?
You can't talk to men down here the way you would at home. They don't understand it.
Understand what?
They think you mean it.
Mean what?
Doesn't it bother you at all that you're married?
What I want to know is, does it bother you?
It was at this time that Rita received her first film contract and her first name change. She became Rita Cancino and signed a 6-month agreement to work with Fox. Her roles at this time played into the exotic foreigner, with her appearing in features like Under the Pampas Moon and Charlie Chan in Egypt. But Fox studio head Daryl F. Zanuck didn't get Hayworth's appeal and failed to renew her contract after the 6 months was up. After a marriage to promoter Edward C. Judson, Cancino would sign a 7-year contract with Columbia. Columbia's boss, Harry Cohn, felt Cancino was too Mediterranean in her appearance, and that her last name sounded too Spanish, so she'd always be stuck playing exotic characters. Rita Cancino borrowed her mother's maiden name of Hayworth and became the newly minted Rita Hayworth. She also went so far as to dye her dark brown hair red, used electrolysis to alter the shape of her hairline, and got a nose job. So by the time she appeared in the 1937 Cary Grant drama Only Angels Have Wings, Hayworth was a totally different woman than the one she'd started out as. Upon that film's release, Columbia was actually inundated with fan mail for the actress, leaving Cohn to realize that Rita Hayworth was set to be Columbia's biggest star.
What are you crying about?
I feel great, Johnny.
You look foolish.
I'll show you why.
Where's the canary?
How did you know?
How did I know what?
So you don't know. Come. Gilda, are you decent?
Me? Sure, I'm decent. So this is Johnny Farrell. I've heard a lot about you, Johnny Farrell.
Really? Now, I haven't heard a word about you.
Why, Ballin?
I wanted to keep it as a surprise.
Was it a surprise, Mr. Farrell?
It certainly was. You should have seen his face.
Did you tell him what I'm doing here, Ballin?
No, I wanted to save that as a surprise, too.
Hang on to your hat, Mr. Farrell.
Gilda is my wife, Johnny.
In the decade after Rita Hayworth's appearance in Only Angels Have Wings and her role in Gilda, she was the top box office draw for Columbia, appearing in nearly every genre of film from drama to musical. Harry Cohn became incredibly particular about what films Hayworth would appear in, cultivating every picture to be the perfect Hayworth vehicle. He tasked Virginia Van Upp, who had just written the script for Hayworth's greatest success at the time, 1944's Cover Girl, with a film that would showcase her sex appeal. Gilda was initially created as a straightforward drama, with nary a musical number to be found. The film was also planned to be shot in Technicolor, but the cameras were unavailable, and this was actually to Hayworth's benefit, as she found Technicolor to be an incredibly arduous process as an actress. The script went through several story changes to mitigate the presumed sordidness, and even when shooting commenced, changes were being made. Though Gilda lives and dies based on Hayworth's performance, finding a leading man to work opposite her was a challenge. Glenn Ford hadn't been in a movie since 1943 when he'd left to go into the service, but he was a comfortable choice for her. She'd worked with him in the 1940 film The Lady in Question. The movie was old home week for Rita Hayworth, right down to getting Charles Vidor to direct after his work with the actress on Cover Girl.
You do hate me, don't you, Johnny?
I don't think you have any idea how much.
Hate is a very exciting emotion. Haven't you noticed? Very exciting. I hate you too, Johnny. I hate you so much that I think I'm going to die from it.
Gilda's eventual release would personify Hayworth's bombshell persona, and though Cohn feared that the actress playing a character you love to hate would ruin her audience appeal, it actually didn't. Both men and women were entranced by her and Gilda as a movie. Financially, the film was a huge boon for Hayworth, whose agent demanded that Harry Cohn provide her with a percentage of the net profits on future films. Cohn obviously refused, but after Hayworth phoned in sick on a few films, Cohn ended up relenting. Hayworth would form the Beckworth Corporation after this, netting 25% of her film's net profits while she worked with Columbia. Despite the movie giving Hayworth lasting screen immortality, she did believe it had cursed her. She famously once said, quote, "Every man I've known has fallen in love with Gilda and awakened with me." Hayworth's career would continue into the early 70s, but many said she never quite captured the same joie de vivre that she showed in Gilda. When we return, Nell Manow will join me to look a bit closer at the shadowy world of Gilda.
When they had the earthquake in San Francisco back in 1906, they said that old Mother Nature was up to her old tricks. That's the story that went around, but here's the real lowdown. Put the blame on Maine, boy. Put the blame on Maine. One night she started to shim and shake. That brought on the Frisco quake.
The month of June means that we are celebrating the love goddess herself, actress Rita Hayworth. And I am joined by the wonderful and amazing Nell Manow for this month. Nell, how are you?
I am great. It's great to be back on the show.
That's right. It's been over a year since you were on. I believe we were talking about classic film discoveries last time. Still one of my top listened to episodes. I think you're a good luck charm for the podcast now.
Well, we'll see if we can top it with this one. We certainly have got a great topic.
That's right. We are talking about the 1946 film noir Gilda, considered one of the landmark film noir movies and the landmark Rita Hayworth film. Last month we did John Dahl, and we looked at pretty much the only two movies I think most people know him for, which was Gun Crazy and Rope. Well, with Rita, we're going to look at two of the movies that I think define her career, and mostly are defined by her hair, because we're talking about Gilda, and then on the next episode we're talking about Lady from Shanghai. Two very different movies that resulted in two very different outcomes. Directed by Charles Vidor, it stars the aforementioned Rita Hayworth and Glenn Ford. It's the story of a small-time gangster, Johnny Farrell, played by Glenn Ford, who ends up in Argentina and gets a job working for Balan Munson, played by George McCready, who runs a casino. Thinks that things are maybe a little weird between them. This is another episode that's going to have like homoeroticism all over the place. Johnny's life is complicated even more when he realizes that Balan is married to Gilda, played by Rita Hayworth, who was once Johnny's ex-girlfriend. They used to be lovers, and now they're not. Thus, we get a triangle of double entendres. Weirdness abounds, all of it very beautifully filmed and captured on screen and in beautiful black and white. But now, we already introduced you on the last episode, but in case people don't know who you are, why don't we give a very brief rundown of what you do in your free time before we start deconstructing Gilda.
All right. Well, I am a classic movie fan and a current movie critic. I write it for MovieMom.com, and also I've written for the Huffington Post, RogerEbert.com, The Credits, which is the Motion Picture Association's website. So I've done about 3,500 movie reviews and about 700 interviews of filmmakers, and I've written several books about movies.
What is your background with Rita Hayworth and this movie? I'm assuming you'd seen it before we recorded.
Yes, I did. I think I first saw it actually when I was in film school, and I've always thought of it as having the toughest dialogue of any movie I've ever seen. You wouldn't normally think of Glenn Ford, who's kind of an all-purpose guy. You know, he could do light comedy, he could do drama, he did a lot of westerns, and of course he was Rita Hayworth's most frequent co-star. They worked very, very well together. But you don't really think of him necessarily as being a gangster, and you don't think of him also, I think, as being super sexy, but he and Rita Hayworth really create a tremendous amount of chemistry in this movie. She has a line in this movie that is really one of the craziest ever, where she says something like, "I hate you so much I would destroy myself if I could take you down with me." And of course, the first time we see Rita Hayworth in this movie is one of the most iconic moments in the history of movies. And the hair is very important. We'll be talking a lot about her hair because we see her sort of shaking her hair back. She had been bending over and she stands up. And there's just something that is just fell out of bed, smoking hot about her when she does that.
Yeah, this is a movie that I think I had seen other people reference it before I had seen it. If you don't know this movie, you've probably seen it referenced in Shawshank Redemption.
Right, and I think everybody is familiar with the dance number that she does movie as well, which is one of the most iconic in the history of film. And by today's standards, maybe it doesn't look quite as incendiary as it did back then, put the blame on Mame. But it's partly the content of the song, which, of course, was dubbed by somebody else because she was not a singer. But she was a dancer going back to when she was just 3 years old. And just the way that she takes off her glove and that dance number is very sexy.
This was one of those movies, when I did finally see it, I was just mesmerized by it. People say something like Double Indemnity is the quintessential noir. I think it's this movie. I think this is the Casablanca of noir, which might be a controversial statement, because you get all the noirish tropes, the emphasis on shadow and light. There's a lot of characters that are in shadow. The blacks are really inky in this movie. You have Rita Hayworth, who is just otherworldly beautiful, playing a femme fatale that I don't necessarily know if you could say she's fatale, because she doesn't actually commit any crime in this movie. It's mostly the men who are doing things.
She inspires some crimes.
She inspires some crimes, yes.
And you can tell, and I want to say this about Rita Hayworth generally, that you can tell in this movie about her character, and I think in all of her most successful movies, or almost all of her most successful movies, you can tell she's a girl who's been around. She's seen a few things. She was never really one to play the innocent girl next door. She was always somebody who had had a lot of struggles and was good on the inside, was not going to be easy to get to know.
No, and I think watching this, I had watched this and seen Rita Hayworth, and then you go back, you look at her career before this, and it's so different. It's not different in the way that, like, Ida Lupino was different, because she started playing a completely different set of characters, but when she was just Rita Cancino back in her early career, I mean, she tried to play the nice girls. You know, I remember her in something like the Jane Withers movie Patio Day, where she plays Jane Withers' adult friend. And it didn't really work. There's not a lot of charisma there. She always did good, I think, at playing characters that, right, had been around. Which I think brings up the one thing that I noticed about this movie now, that this is one of two movies that actually came out around 1946 that had these post-World War II stories about Nazis reconstituting themselves in other countries. In this case, you find out Bahlen Munson is an ex-Nazi who has been living in Buenos Aires. It also has a horrific relationship at it, not unlike Notorious, the Alfred Hitchcock movie. And I was watching it because I love Notorious, but Notorious is one of those problematic faves for me because it's a similar tone in here. all about slut shaming. Both Ingrid Bergman and Rita Hayworth's characters are constantly told to prove their love, constantly tested, because they are perceived to be trashy in some way, whether it's Ingrid Bergman's character being the daughter of a Nazi, or Rita Hayworth's character here, who is just perceived to be, per Johnny, she's a slut. She's slept around. And you never really know if any of that is true. And I really appreciate that, because I think it leads me to say that Rita Hayworth's character is this early 1940s, I don't want to use the term feminist hero, but she kind of is, in that she's constantly maligned, constantly told she's bad by other people. And then you find out at the end that throughout the movie, she has these wonderful moments of tenderness with other characters and sweetness that Glenn Ford's character just doesn't see.
I completely agree with you about that. I think that your comparison to Notorious is brilliant. I hope we can have another show where we can talk about that movie.
Oh, yeah.
Which I'm completely fascinated by. If we can digress for a second, I want to say something about Notorious, which is you're absolutely right about the slut shaming. One of the things that makes Notorious so magnetic is that the Cary Grant character, who is not the charming Cary Grant we all know, he's got some issues himself. On the one hand, he desperately needs her to sleep with Claude Rains so that he can get what he wants. On the other hand, he's jealous and angry about it, too.
Yeah.
And that's that whole chemistry. And the same thing here with Rita Hayworth is, in both of the movies that we're going to be talking about, in this one and The Lady from Shanghai, the main character wonders why she's with the old rich guy and is angry about it, is resentful about it, is threatened by it, and all of that. I want to say, though, as a footnote, she did always play, most believably, a woman who's been around. We think about her playing Sadie Thompson. We think about her in Pal Joey, where she plays a socialite who at one time was a stripper. And yet in her two musicals with Fred Astaire, which are practically indistinguishable, they're almost the same movie, You Were Never Lovelier and You'll Never Get Rich, and her musical with Gene Kelly, Cover Girl, she's kind of a game girl. She's like, I'm independent. I'm willing to do what it takes to get what I need. But it's a sort of sweeter version of this femme fatale that we see in these dramatic movies. And I have to say that as much as I loved Ginger Rogers, I think Rita Hayworth was the best partner that Fred Astaire ever had, because she brought such joie de vivre to the roles. Nobody ever looked happier dancing with Fred Astaire than Rita Hayworth did.
You Were Never Lovelier is probably one of my favorite musicals. It's one that's not talked about nearly enough. A, the costumes rival this for in some regards for me. I don't think she's given enough credit for the range that she had in terms of being able to do musicals, in terms of being able to do these serious dramas. And I think a lot of that had to do with persona, because, as we all know, Gilda was a double-edged sword for her, career-wise.
Right. She famously said, as Julia Roberts quotes her as saying in Notting Hill, she famously said, every man she married went to bed with Gilda and woke up with her.
Exactly. It was a movie that made her career, but there was this penchant to want to have her recreate that all the time. And when she didn't, as we'll talk about The Lady from Shanghai, it didn't really work out so well for her. It's amazing to watch her in this movie. She'd just given birth to a child a couple months before filming this. And she was known for marrying, much like the character here, she married a lot of titans of whether it's royalty or whether it was filmmaking with Orson Welles. It's unclear where the lines between Gilda ended and she began sometimes. What I really appreciate about this movie is that she's able to take those lines. This movie has one of the best scripts, filled with so many double entendres and one-liners, and she, I think, is the most comfortable saying some of these lines. If I was a ranch, they'd call me the bar nothing. And you need a character. You can't have just some cheeky girl like a Marilyn flippantly put those out. Gilda is a character that, I know Balin calls her a child, but I think she proves that she's an adult who knows that she's manipulating and irritating other characters, especially Johnny. I mean, part of their whole foreplay thing, that the dance they do for this entire movie, is just to irritate him.
Oh, no question about it. And I think that's kind of what makes her character so fascinating in this, is that you know that she is maintaining this very tough outside because she is so tender, so vulnerable, so damaged on the inside. And she just can't risk letting that happen again.
We're introduced to Glenn Ford first. Gilda actually shows up about, what, 25 minutes into the movie?
Really think it's going to be his story, but it really turns out to be her story.
It really is hers. That's what I like about this movie, because as the film progresses, we're introduced to Johnny as he's the typical noir guy. He could be Fred McMurray. He could be any other guy. He makes his own luck. He's this con man, card shark type of person who lives on his feet. And he thinks that he's gotten this jackpot by being employed by Marilyn Manson. And he tries not to let a woman get in the way of it. And then the movie changes. Charles Vidor changes the focus, because once Balin disappears, Johnny and Gilda quickly get married, and then Gilda realizes that she needs to get out of this abusive relationship, and she decides to flee. The movie firmly becomes her film. And it's not to disparage Glenn Ford. It's great that him and Rita Hayworth, this was the second of five films they did together. And there were rumors that there was this long-standing love affair between the two of them. He actually took care of her in her later years when she developed Alzheimer's. But I like that it's not his story, because this is a woman that I think is too complex for noir, almost. She's got this history to her. She's got this life. I think Johnny said they don't have past, they're all futures, but she does. She's judged for her past at every turn by every character, and she just wants to persevere and live her life, and I just want to shout from the rooftop, let Gilda live!
Now, I'm going to say something that you might disagree with, and that is, I think you will agree with this part, that there's a difference between a movie star and an actor. And
yes,
there are very, very few people who are both, who have just that tremendous charisma and screen presence and also are actors. And I would put her in the movie star category. I don't think she was a great actress, but she did have an incredible screen charisma and a power on screen. And if you are going to ask her to deliver a line like, I hate you so much, I think I'm going to die from it, she really will nail that line. When I say I don't think she's a great actress, she was not asked to have a lot of range on screen.
Right.
She's not Meryl Streep. She's not going to be adopting a new accent with every role. But in terms of being everything that you want in a movie star, from the gorgeous looks to the way she moved, the way that the key light was always in her eyes, she just glowed. She really brought it. Now, let's talk about her as a person for a minute. All of the things that we just mentioned, the vulnerability, having been through it, somebody who has dealt with a lot in the past, has done whatever it takes to survive, that was really her. I mean,
yeah,
she was that person. She had an abusive father. She was forced to work as a dancer from age 3 and a half on. You can see on YouTube her as a 16-year-old dancing in a Spencer Tracy movie, and you can see how hard she works. And I watched an interview with her to prepare for our conversation where she said, well, I like to work. I want to be working all the time. And you can tell that she really does. And Fred Astaire, by the way, said that of all the women that he had danced with, she was the one where he would show her the steps before lunch. And by the time they came back from lunch, she had it all down, because she was a professional. She had been dancing all that time, and she was incredibly focused and dedicated. But she also was very vulnerable. She got married for the first time very, very, very young to get away from her family. Every man that she married turned out to be a total disaster. They didn't treat her well. They had affairs. And as she said, they wanted to be married to this exotic creature, and it turned out to be a regular person. And so all of that is up on the screen. You really see that in her.
And I love that this movie is set in Argentina. We don't really talk about the fact that technically Rita Hayworth's Latina. She comes from Spanish heritage. Her father
was from Cancino.
Her father was Spanish. Her mother was Irish and English. Her grandfather popularized the bolero. So when she's speaking Spanish, there's a very quick scene in this movie where she actually speaks Spanish. I love that. The Latino actors were able to do a bit more with their heritage, but not really the actresses. If you look at Fox publicity photos of Rita Cancino, I mean, you can tell they altered her appearance, changed the hairline, dyed the hair to really downplay her ethnic look.
Yeah, and meanwhile, they're taking Myrna Loy and trying to sell her as an Oriental,
right?
Which is the word that they used in those days.
Yeah.
And I mean, who knows? Hollywood and ethnicity, that's a subject for, you know, five or six different shows. But they certainly were trying to, they made her change her name to her mother's maiden name. They dyed her hair. They wanted to make her look more Anglo. It is wonderful to see her speaking a little bit of Spanish. And she does a Spanish dance in that Spencer Tracy movie I mentioned, but you don't get to see that very often with her.
We brought up the slut shaming that goes on with her character. I think she has a lot of fun, or at least tries to play that up. There's a moment in the movie that I really like where she's talking about, to go back to her heritage, she brings up, there's two things Latin men are known for. One of them is, and then she stops, and then she asks him, what's your phone number? I think that scene is hilarious, because this is a movie that is incredibly saucy for 1946. I know Isn't Notorious gets the flair for how Hitchcock subverted the kissing rule, but this has just some saucy lines. It's so sexy.
The very first time we see her, are you decent? And then she says, sure, I'm decent.
Yeah. Well, and that word, I think, comes back to haunt her when Gianni puts the portrait up of Balin in the house and she says, well, it's not decent. He says, well, that's a funny word coming out of your mouth. I just want to punch Glenn Ford in this whole movie.
So does she.
Well, exactly. If you look at some of the posters that were used to sell Gilda, one of them says, I was true to one man once and look what happened. And it's this concept of she's trapped in two abusive marriages. She says, would she have done that twice if she could have avoided it? And I think she's written as this character that could have easily been a woman who uses sex to get attention. To put the blame on Mame number at the end of the movie when she's asking men to undress her. There's nothing particularly sexy about that if you're really watching it the right way. It really plays out like a poor woman who's just lost everything and she just wants to be nothing at this point. This character could have really been something to lampoon if written wrong.
Oh, I agree. Really, the sauciest thing about the put the blame on Mame number are the lyrics. Because she's singing about basically the devil is a woman throughout history. Yeah, she's swinging her hips and taking off her glove, but that's really who that character is. She's saying, I'm the bad girl. I'm responsible for all the disasters that have happened.
You read Put the Blame on Mame, the lyrics, literally. I looked at it, it was like, yeah, women have been blamed for everything since Adam and Eve, and that sucks. Again, I'm unclear if audiences in 1946 took that to mean that women are blamable for everything, but I think that as this movie has aged and we've had these changing views on women, the impact of it is different.
I agree with you, but I want to go back to what I thought was a very good point that you made about how it came out just after World War II.
Right.
Because that was a time we were still not aware of some of the terrible atrocities of the Holocaust, but it was a time when just the very concept, the very sort of existential idea of who we were had been shaken very, very deeply. We'd lost many, 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 many people. There had been attacks all over the world. The nuclear bombs had gone off. And so this is really a reflection of us trying to decide who we are going forward. And in a way, we're kind of like Rita Hayworth. We've experienced terrible damage. We're feeling very vulnerable. We have to have a tough exterior. Where do we go from here?
The fact that it's set in Argentina, which was part of the good neighbor policy that America had with Latin America, it's still presented as, not to use Casablanca again as an example, but it's hard not to, this isolated kind of place of hedonism where the champagne's flowing and the money's changing hands. And I think even Glenn Ford says, oh, at a certain point, the war ended. And that's really all you get is a couple newspaper lines.
Right.
It doesn't intrude on their lifestyle. And so at the end, when Gilda makes the decision to go back to America, it's more important that I think that Glenn Ford says, take me with you, because both of these characters have been running from what we knew was going on. And they're both making this mutual decision to go back and deal with the realities that we were only going to figure out as the years went on really happened with World War II. It really ties in nicely to this question of how do we process this? And especially from the female perspective, women have been given this taste of freedom. And then we're told, go back home. We don't need you working anymore. How do they deal with that changing gender role too, which I really like.
And I think that war, by its nature, has a lawlessness to it. Argentina represented that here, that there was almost like the days of the pirates.
Yeah.
You know, you have major criminal activity going on and everything seems to be corrupt. And I think that by going back to the United States, and that was like going back to a place where the rules matter, where people can live a clean life.
Well, I do have to wonder, I brought up Casablanca twice now. I think the ending too is very similar to Casablanca. The lovers are off the hook. Obregon, who is the cop that's been trying to like get Munson for this murder, he's willing to turn the other cheek, not unlike Claude Rains telling them to round up all the usual suspects.
And I think of it a little bit like To Have and Have Not, too.
Yes. I don't know how this movie could have ended, necessarily, in a way that would have been satisfying. The ending is the only thing that I have issues with, just because it feels flat. You're expecting something a bit more bombastic. Fallon shows up in the last 3 minutes of the movie and is quickly vanquished, and that's it. But I don't know how they could have done it any differently.
Well, partly because it is such a tangled mess, that plot. And even that pales by comparison with the one we'll be talking about next time. If anybody can explain the plot of Lady from Shanghai, I'll take my hat off to them.
But I did want to bring up, of course, it's supposed to be Glenn Ford's movie. And Glenn Ford is good. It's hard not to watch this movie without talking about my favorite thing on the podcast, which is homoeroticism. And I don't know how it just keeps popping up in movies, but here it pops up a lot. We talked about Rope a couple weeks ago, and I said that was Hitchcock's gayest film. This is pretty homoerotic noir.
It certainly is.
Oh, yeah. It's almost immediate.
The relationship between Munson and Johnny is extremely, I mean, really shockingly for that era, very, I'm just going to say, interdependent. And yeah, there's a homoeroticism to it. Why did he hire him? It's almost like Sidney Greenstreet and Elisha Cook Jr.
It's immediate. I think they said they tried to mute the homoeroticism, and both Glenn Ford and Charles Vidor said like they didn't notice anything. And maybe that's true, but I think it's pretty overt. From the first minute you meet Fallon Munson, when he whips out the cane that has the dagger in it. He mentions his little friend, and it's silent when he wishes it to be silent, and it talks when he wants it to talk. And the cane comes out at certain points of the movie, usually when it's just him and Johnny alone in a room together. You can watch this movie and question something like Notorious, or in other noirs, something like Double Indemnity. The lovers are trying to off the third wheel. Munson gets the drop on these two. He tells Johnny, I bought you the way I bought Gilda. And you're never really clear on whether he knew about their background. He alludes to it. He questions whether he
did. Yeah, I always felt, my theory is, that was what drew him to Gilda in the first place.
Right.
You know, maybe he can't have sex with Johnny, but he'll have sex with somebody who had sex with Johnny.
Exactly. Well, and I mean, again, you can read all of this with homoerotic. Johnny acts like a jealous lover, but he seems to be more jealous of Gilda. He says women and gambling don't mix. How is she going to intrude on everything? In his voiceover, he says he wants to watch their relationship with the connotation that he wants to see them have sex. I think at one point Rita Hayworth says a psychiatrist would say your thoughts are very revealing to Johnny. I mean, all of this just plays out this relationship where you're watching two ex-lovers spar. Are you looking at two people who love the same man and are irritated that the other one exists? The best movies just of any genre are movies where you can read that subtext and find something new to appreciate whether you believe that or not.
Right. I felt that Munson wanted to punish Johnny for having had been together with Gilda before he got there, but he also was very drawn to Johnny and wanted to kind of screw him by proxy.
Most people say, oh, I don't notice homoeroticism in the movies. I think it's hard not to notice it in this.
Oh, no, I think it's about as obvious as in any movie that's ever been made. And I think a very important exchange in the movie is when Gilda says to Munson, don't worry about Johnny, I hate him. And he says, and he hates you. That's very apparent. But hate can be a very exciting emotion. Very exciting. There's a heat in it that one can feel.
George McCready is really good in this movie. He doesn't get a lot of screen time. He's gone for pretty much the third act. But it's impossible to dissociate this movie from being this weird menage a trois of lovers questioning who knows what, when, who do they want? Do they all want each other? That makes the movie so exciting and so enticing.
Yeah, he's very good. And remember, he says, hate is the only thing that has ever warmed me, which is, again, what's the first thing I said of the movie? It has the toughest dialogue I've ever seen, you know, line for line. everything in this movie is so tough. And for him to say, hate is the only thing that has ever warmed me, that really tells you a lot about why he put himself in the middle of this triangle.
Well, and he says, Johnny takes care of everything that belongs to me. And so once Johnny does take over as Munson, you can tell that the movie loses something because he's not Munson. He's not living the same lifestyle. And once you lose that part of the love triangle, it does change how you watch the movie because, I don't want to keep using the phrase, but it's so homoerotic that you're like, I don't know if I necessarily buy the sexual chemistry between him and Gilda when Fallon's gone, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. I mean, and how many movies of that era have somebody say you must lead a gay life?
And it makes you question when Fallon leaves, you're left to wonder if Johnny's just kind of a misogynist. I think you can read it either way.
It's a very different era.
Yes.
But that kind of goes to the whole slut shaming issue, because one of the core elements of much misogyny is the idea that you both want to have sex with somebody, but you hate them for making you want to have sex with them, and you hate them for having had sex with you because then they're not pure anymore. So that's a very misogynistic attitude that is quite prevalent in movies of that era.
Well, I think it all works in tandem, is essentially what it is. I mean, I think all of these are kind of going in the pot. It comes out and it makes this beautiful movie. We didn't talk about Jean Louise gowns. Some of the costumes are just, oh my gosh, I love that Rita Hayworth's all bare shoulders in this movie. For the most part, most of her outfits are either halters or bare shoulders. The Put the Blame on Mame dress is practically falling off of her in the one scene. But we have great designers, your Ori Kellys and your Dolly Trees and all of that. But here, those skin-tight sheath dresses that Rita Hayworth wears, they're so iconic. I don't want to use the term they're like a snake skin because I don't want to imply that Rita Hayworth's character is necessarily duplicitous, but that's the point, is that they're supposed to be like the apotheosis of Slinky.
No question about it. As I think you know, I'm the mother of a costume designer in Hollywood.
Right.
So I pay a lot of attention to the costumes. He worked with her a great deal. He worked with her on Tonight and Every Night, Lady from Shanghai, which we'll be talking about later, Miss Sadie Thompson, which I think is an underrated film of hers, Salome, and they really got each other. They really understood each other, and he had a great elegance and sophistication in his work.
Well, Nell, is there anything else you want to touch on before we close it out?
I just want to go back to the hair.
Go for it. Yes, go for it.
Because that's something where we have a huge contrast next week. And it may be exaggerating a little bit to say that one of the reasons that nobody liked Lady from Shanghai was that she didn't have the long hair.
It's the worst haircut since Felicity, since Carrie Russell. In terms of people talking about it.
It is a terrible haircut. But you have really sort of the alpha and omega here. In this movie, not only does she have absolutely gorgeous hair that looks like $1 million, but she uses it so well. The way that she, in that very first scene, the way that she shakes her hair, the way that she uses it when she dances, the hair is gorgeous in this movie and really is part of what makes her such an icon.
Yeah, I don't know any other actress that could be defined, not necessarily defined by their hair, but uses their hair in such a distinctive way. Everybody knows Marilyn's hair, but Marilyn's hair never really becomes something you're drawn to when you watch her movies. And here, when she's doing the hair flip, the way the hair moves when she's dancing, it's free in a way where you can tell it's not a lot of product. I'm sure there's a ton of product in it, but it feels like it's not shellacked and gelled. There's not a lot of design to it. I think
it really moves.
Yes.
And it has that tousle. It really exemplifies her free spirit through the hair. She shakes it, she moves it, it moves, and it's got that voluptuousness to it.
Everybody associates the 40s with the rollers and the curls and all of that, and you don't get that here. You get a woman whose hair looks like she probably combed it, and that's just how it is. I am jealous of it, though. I have really thick hair, and my hair does not look like that, no matter what I do to it.
Well, you know and I know that every 10 minutes they stopped filming and 14 people descended on her to make it look like it was just fell out of bed tousled. But it sure does. And,
exactly.
It is great.
Listeners, you can let me know your thoughts on Rita Hayworth, Gilda, anything else. You can email them to me at ticklishbays@gmail.com, and I'll read them on the next episode. Once again, I'd like to thank Nell Minow for joining me today. Nell, we know you'll be back next time, but where can fans find and get in touch with you in the meantime?
You can find me at moviemom.com, and you can email me at moviemom@moviemom.com.
That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. As always, you can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of different ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please consider helping the podcast out by leaving a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly with questions, comments, suggestions at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, or visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysandclassicfilm.com. And you can also get in touch with me via Twitter, as well as learn what's happening on the show. Our Twitter handle is @ticklish_biz. Want to learn more about upcoming episodes or hear exclusive content before anyone else? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast it is. Right now, patrons can hear my interview with Michael Curtiz biographer Alan K. Rohde, and I'll also be putting up my TCM Classic Film Festival audio over the coming weeks. I know I keep promising that. It's gonna happen. Just hasn't happened on the time frame that I'm comfortable with right now. And becoming a patron just gets more beneficial, as I'm actually working on 2 monthly supplemental podcasts. And patrons already know what the podcasts are, but I figure enough time has passed, I can tell the general listeners. There's an untitled one right now. I'm still looking for a title, so if you have suggestions, please let me know. We'll be looking at various films, and there are sometimes multiple movie remakes. That's going to have co-host Adam Kauser there. We're going to be looking at stuff from Little Women to the upcoming remake of A Star is Born, as well as all the films made before their remake. So, should be very interesting. The other one is called Based on a True Podcast. That's going to see me and new co-host William Bibiani, who you might remember from our Fair to Remember episode, as we discuss old Hollywood crime dramas and biopics through the films made about them. So if there's a movie about a true Hollywood crime or biopic, we're going to be talking about it. Stuff like Hollywoodland, LA Confidential, Mommy Dearest, a lot of movies that I've wanted to talk about, just haven't really had the time or theme to fit them in there. So if you are a fan of true crime or how Hollywood portrays itself, you're going to want to check that out. If you're interested in becoming a patron and learning more, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Want to learn more about the stars turning 100 this year? Well, if you're a member of TCM's exclusive fan club, TCM Backlot, you can read my year-long centennial celebration series about the stars spotlighted here, discussing films and information that you won't hear on the show. Next time, Nell Manow is back with me as we talk about the film that almost ruined Rita Hayworth's career and definitely ruined her hair, the 1947 Orson Welles film The Lady from Shanghai. Till next time.